And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, June 4th, 2015. I want to suggest that maybe you have a pencil and paper handy, something you could write something down on, because there might be something you want to remember later. URLs, web pages, whatever you want to call them, maybe an email address. Maybe a date, a time, a phone number, a place. If you write it down, you'll remember it later. I guess you could listen to the rebroadcast. But anyway, let's get started with announcements. Rebel Rebuild Rewild 2015 is going to be happening up in the forest north of Ottawa, Canada. That's the Canadian version of the Round River Rendezvous. It's addressed to dear comrades, rabble-rousers, nature-loving radicals, and aspiring revolutionaries. Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild is an eco-anarchist action camp for those of us who dream of a wild future where we can meet, get to know each other, educate one another, learn skills, and organize for the liberation of Mother Earth. We believe that on behalf of future generations, the oppressed people of today, and all our relations, we are called to take actions to defend the water, air, land, and biodiversity upon which our very survival depends. Anyway, we are counting on you to make this camp happen. You're accepting proposals for workshops, skill shares, discussions, trainings, and activities. Write to Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild, all one word, at riseup.net. Tell us what you can offer. And once again, that is RRR 2015 in Canada, June 22nd through the 28th, in a beautiful forest setting north of Ottawa. And it says more details will be forthcoming, so listen right here. If I can find out where they are, I'll let you know. Also coming up over the July 4th weekend will be the Round River Rendezvous. I haven't seen any information on that yet. But we'll keep you updated on that. Actually, try and find some information next week about the specifics of the Round River Rendezvous. I think it's back east somewhere this year. Vermont, maybe? New Hampshire? Somewhere back there. But I haven't heard anything about it, so hopefully we'll hear more soon. Oregon Wild announces the Tim Lillibeau Wildlands Warrior Award. Oregon Wild is proud to announce that the recipient of the first annual Tim Lillibeau Wildlands Warriors Award is Dave Willis of the Soda Mountain Wilderness Council. Willis was nominated for his tireless work in the Klamath Siskiyou region of Oregon that he's worked for decades to protect. Since 1983, Willis has worked with federal agency officials, local community leaders, and congressional representatives in efforts to preserve the Soda Mountain area where the Siskiyou Mountains join the Southern Cascades. In 2000, as a result of Willis's work and persistence, President Clinton declared 53,000 acres around Soda Mountain as the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. This accomplishment was not the end of Willis's advocacy, and he continued to work for wilderness designation of the monument's southern backcountry. 9 years later, Congress designated the Soda Mountain Wilderness Area within the National Monument as part of the Omnibus Public Land Management Act of 2009. Of the many everyday heroes that labor to protect and preserve the wild Oregon that we love, Dave Willis is especially deserving of our admiration, gratitude, and celebration, said Oregon Wild Executive Director Sean Stevens. Upon announcement of the award, Dave is humble and will say he does not deserve this award, but those who know what he has accomplished will be excited to honor him. Willis continues to advocate for protecting the biodiversity of the Klamath Siskiyou region and expanding the boundaries of the protected areas. He has also been instrumental in coordinating the large-scale buyouts of grazing leases covering the monument. Today, the monument and many of the immediately adjacent lands are almost entirely cow-free, and Willis has helped establish a nationwide model for grazing buyouts that will have an impact on conservation efforts far and beyond his southern Oregon home. Tim Lillibeau was a great friend and mentor for 33 years, said Willis. Many of us have still not recovered from his southern loss. He was indeed a wildlands advocate that the rest of us can only hope to approximate. It's a bittersweet, beyond humbling honor to receive an award with Tim's name on it. I hope we can all do him proud going forward as we work to protect and recover Oregon's wild places. Dave Willis was presented the award publicly at the Oregon Wilderness Conference on May 16th in Portland. Willis received a gift of $5,000 cash and will be featured in an issue of the Oregon Wild Newsletter magazine. And here's a little note about the Tim Lillibue or Lillibeau Wildlands Warrior Award. For more than 40 years, conservation pioneer Tim Lillibeau devoted his life to protecting and restoring old-growth forests, rugged canyons, whitewater, and wildlife of Oregon. From the Marble Halls of Congress to the dusty trails of the Deschutes, Malheur, and Willowa Whitman National Forests, his passion and dedication set the standard for Oregon's conservation community to follow. As a result of his efforts, hundreds and thousands of acres of wilderness and old growth have been safeguarded as a legacy that will be appreciated for generations to come. This is the inaugural year of Oregon Wild's Tim Lillibeau Wildlands Warrior Award, established to recognize the work of heroes who embody Lillibeau's perseverance and fearlessness in advocating for Oregon's treasures. The goal of this recognition is to celebrate those who share the commitment to conservation that Tim held so fiercely and to inspire a new generation of Oregonians to follow his example in the fight to protect the wildlands, wildlife, and waters that make Oregon such a special place. For more information, go to www.oregonwild.org. And the California Department of Public Health warns people not to eat certain seafood caught in the Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. The California Department of Public Health is advising consumers not to eat recreationally harvested mussels and clams. Don't go out on the rocks and pick those off and eat them. However, commercially or recreationally caught anchovies and sardines or the internal organs of commercially or recreationally caught crab taken from Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. Let me repeat that. Recreational harvests of mussels and clams, any anchovies or sardines caught locally, or the internal organs of crabs from Monterey and Santa Cruz County. Now, that's not the meat, that's the organs. California Department of Public Health is working with commercial fishermen in the area to ensure that recently harvested anchovy and sardines are not distributed into the human food supply. Dangerous levels of domoic acid have been detected in some of these species and are also likely to be present in other species. Molluscan bivalve shellfish, anchovy, and sardines are especially of concern because the toxin resides in their digestive tract, and these seafood products are not normally eviscerated prior to consumption. So clean those sardines. The California Department of Public Health is continuing to collect a variety of molluscan bivalve shellfish, finfish, and crab samples from the area to monitor the levels of domoic acid. This warning does not apply to commercially sold clams, mussels, scallops, or oysters from approved sources. State law permits only state-certified commercial shellfish harvesters or dealers to sell these products. Shellfish sold by certified harvesters and dealers are subject to frequent mandatory testing to monitor for toxins. Here you go. Symptoms of domoic acid poisoning can occur within 30 minutes to 24 hours after eating toxic seafood. In mild cases, symptoms may include vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, headache, and dizziness. These symptoms disappear within several days. In severe cases, the victim may experience trouble breathing, have confusion, disorientation, cardiovascular instability, seizures, excessive bronchial secretions, permanent loss of short-term memory, coma, or death. There have been no reported illnesses associated with the current event. Once again, don't eat seafood, wild or recreational harvested mussels, clams, anchovies, sardines, or the internal organs of crab from the Monterey or Santa Cruz areas. And threats led to humans killing a wolf. In this story by John Larson of the Albuquerque Journal, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has killed wolf M1130, a male Mexican wolf, in Catron County, and I believe that's in New Mexico, after several incidents involving people and residences, according to a memorandum written by Benjamin Tuggle, director of the Southwest Region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Although just released back into the wild on April 21st from captivity at Savalita's Wolf Management Facility, the captive bred M1130 was exhibiting escalating nuisance behavior, including increasing activity near residents and neighborhoods in Catron County. As a result, the Mexican Wolf Interagency Field Team was given permission to try and remove him from the wild. Authorized capture methods included trapping, darting, and lethal take. The IFT had set several traps and made multiple attempts to dart the animal. However, these efforts failed, and they killed the wolf. And here are some things that led to that killing. Late in the evening of May 17th, the interagency field team received notification from Catron County that they are investigating a wolf incident near a trailer on Eagle Peak Road. The incident investigation showed that a wolf was circling around an occupied trailer for approximately 30 minutes until it got dark, despite the resident making noise and trying to scare the wolf out of the area. There was a dog at the trailer that the resident put up right after seeing the wolf, the memorandum said. The next day, the interagency field team documented it was M1130 and stayed in the area that evening to attempt to dart, haze, or set traps if the animal returned to the area. On May 19th, the team searched in vain around Reserve, New Mexico, and Eagle Peak for a signal of the animal. Apparently it's wearing a collar. However, the Catron County Wolf Investigator, who had been in the area of an incident near Luna, called the team at 6 p.m. That situation involved a wolf hanging around a residential area and three separate incidents involving humans. At 8 a.m., a 21-year-old man was fishing for minnows in a creek, saw a wolf watching him from about 15 feet away across the creek. He backed up, but the wolf did not move. At about 10 a.m., a 12-year-old girl was riding her horse and saw what she believed at first hand was a coyote in the field chasing cattle. She rode over to the area and saw that the animal was a wolf. However, her horse spooked and jerked the reins out of her hands. The horse went back towards the house while the wolf was about 30 yards behind. And during the day, a 2-year-old boy was told to feed the dogs outside his house. He indicated to his mother that a neighborhood's dog was out there. She saw that it was actually a wolf and was only 10 to 25 yards away from the boy. The wolf in all three incidents, M1130, was consistently near people and was seen during the day by IFT personnel and the Catron County Wolf Investigator. The IFT chased the wolf and fired a dart but missed. They set traps and left the area but didn't catch the wolf. Next day, checked the traps and set additional traps. In addition, the wolf was seen chasing elk in the general area of the incidents on the previous day. An annual survey of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in February confirmed that there were a total of 19 Mexican wolf packs, with a minimum of 53 wolves spread among the forested lands of New Mexico. And military police have boarded the last two toothfish poaching vessels in Cabo Verde, Africa. Military police have boarded the last two Interpol-wanted toothfish poaching vessels, the Songhua and the Yongding, in Cabo Verde, an archipelago state off the northwest coast of Africa. The action took place thanks to intelligence provided to international law enforcement by Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which had been gathered 2 days prior in a remarkable set of chance circumstances. On Wednesday, May 20th, at approximately 1500 local time, while in Cabo Verde on unrelated business, Captain Peter Hammerstedt of the Sea Shepherd happened upon a vessel that was at anchorage in the Mindelo San Vicente that appeared to him to be remarkably like the wanted poaching vessel Songhua. Captain Hammerstedt forwarded photographs of the vessel, which at the time was carrying the name of Cadet and flagged to Sierra Leone, to the New Zealand Ministry of Primary Industries. The ministries, which have been involved in ongoing investigations of the Songhua, was able to confirm that this was, in fact, the outlawed vessel. Shortly after, Sea Shepherd crew members stationed in Cabo Verde noticed the arrival of a second vessel in Mindelo, which had pulled into port alongside the Songhua. That vessel, which was carrying the name of Luampa and also flagged in Sierra Leone, was later identified as the other wanted poacher, Yongding. The Songhua and Yongding are two of six active illegal, unregulated, unreporting fishing vessels that have been blacklisted for poaching Patagonia and Antarctic toothfish in the waters of Antarctica. The six vessels, which Sea Shepherd calls the Bandit Six, have been the target of the organization's most recent Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish, led by Captain Hammerstead and Captain Sid Chakravarti. Both vessels have had a long and well-documented history of fisheries crimes and are suspected to have links to known Spanish crime syndicate Vidal Armadores. In January this year, the New Zealand Navy intercepted the Sungwa and the Yongding along with a third vessel, the Kunlun, after they were found fishing illegally in waters west of the Ross Sea. The vessels were subsequently issued a Interpol Purple Notice following a petition from Interpol from the New Zealand government. Then in February, the Yongding was again intercepted, this time by the Sea Shepherd ship San Simon, outside of Australia's exclusive economic zone in possession of prohibited fishing gear. The location of the Sanghua, however, has remained unknown until this time. All six of the IUU vessels that have been the target of Operation Icefish have been located, and four are completely out of action. Since March, authorities in Southeast Asia have detained three of the vessels, the Kunlun, the Viking, and most recently the Perlon. On April 6th, the most notorious of the outlawed vessels, the Thunder, was scuttled by its own captain and officers in the waters of São Tomé and Principe off the west coast of Africa following a four-and-a-half-month pursuit by the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker. Authorities in São Tomé and Principe are still holding the captain, chief engineer, and duty engineer of the Thunder as investigations continue. Captains Hammerstead and Chakravarti have called on authorities to ensure that the outlawed vessels are detained in Cabo Verde, and the captain and the officers of the vessels are fully investigated. We are now looking at the very real prospect of being able to completely rid the Southern Ocean of the Bandit Six for good. We urge all relevant authorities to take advantage of this opportunity to fully investigate the Sanghua and the Yongding to ensure that those behind the operations are held accountable for their repeated fishing offenses and that the vessels are detained, hereby eliminating any possibility that they will be used for further illegal operations in Antarctica, said Captain Hammerstead. The successes of Operation Icefish clearly demonstrate that Sea Shepherd's arsenal in the fight against poaching extends far beyond high seas patrols. We have the tools and the experience required to eradicate IUU fishing operations in the Southern Ocean. With the welcomed cooperation from federal law enforcement authorities, coordinated by the expertise of the Environmental Crime Unit of Interpol, that's exactly what we will do, said Captain Chakravarti. Operation Icefish was Sea Shepherd's 11th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign and the first to target IUU fishing operators in the waters of Antarctica. For further information, visit www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And from Canada, we received news that 1,600 captive mink in St. Mary's, Ontario, were liberated by animal activists. And this news from the North American Animal Liberation Press Office, as found on the Earth First Newswire. In a communique received by the Animal Liberation Press Office, anonymous activists have taken credit for the liberation of approximately 1,600 captive mink from an Ontario, Canada fur farm, mink destined to be killed so that their skins can be sold to the fashion industry. The communique reads in full. As many as 1,600 mink were released from cages at the Glenwood Fur Farm, 4216 Perth Line Number 9, in St. Mary's, Ontario, late on May 30th. According to media reports, fencing that surrounds the farms was cut and a gate opened. Animals in two sheds were released and breeding cards removed. Imprisoned in cages for life or mercilessly trapped with painful leg-hold traps in the wild, fur-bearing animals killed to make unnecessary fashion statements are forced to endure intensive confinement compared to the miles of territory these still wild animals would enjoy in their natural state. The natural instincts of these captive animals are completely frustrated. Self-mutilation, sickness, infection, poor sanitation, and the sheer stress of confinement lead animals in captivity to premature death. When they do survive, animals of sufficient size are killed by anal electrocution or gassing and then skinned. In addition to liberating the wild animals destined for certain painful and agonizing death, another goal of liberationists is to cause economic damage to fur retailers and farms. Dozens of stores and fur farming operations have seen economic ruin since Operation Bite Back began by the Animal Liberation Front in the 1990s. Those concerned with the truth should not be misled by claims of those with economic interests. For instance, ridiculous stories that the animals released are domesticated and unable to survive in the wild, or that the animals voluntarily returned to their cages, or that they froze to death or starved within hours, or immediately run over by automobiles or eaten by household pets. Mink are a little bit more substantial than that. Scientific studies have validated that these animals remain genetically wild and are able to survive in a wide range of habitats. The Animal Liberation Front and other anonymous activists utilize economic sabotage in addition to the direct liberation of animals from conditions of abuse and imprisonment to halt needless animal suffering. By making it more expensive to trade in the lives of innocent sentient beings, they maintain the atrocities against our brothers and sisters are likely to occur in smaller numbers. Their goal is to abolish the exploitation, imprisonment, torture, and killing of innocent non-human animals. A copy of The Final Nail, a listing of known fur farms in North America, is available from the press office website at www.animalliberationpressoffice.org. That's animalliberationpressoffice.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Patrols have been lonely the past week as the basin is nearly emptied of buffalo. Each day we seek out the company of the remaining group of bison that has been spending their time safe on the buffalo-friendly private lands of Horse Butte. Each year the field season comes to a close and the majority of volunteers, those not staying on for summer tabling, spread to the four directions to pursue their passions elsewhere. On Wednesday, the last caravan of field volunteers took to the road heading east for other projects, family time, job, and other pursuits. On that day, our scaled-back patrols in the field watched as the last large group of bison spending their time on Horse Butte packed up and headed east, slowly making their way back toward the summer ranges inside Yellowstone National Park to join larger herds and the grounds of the rut. Not to be left out of this seasonal closing, local Montana Department of Livestock Representative Bridger Cunningham went along for the ride, his truck slowly following the migrating group east along the bluffs of the Madison River. We took the opportunity to talk with him, suggesting that if we all just went home and came back tomorrow, the group would likely return to the park on their own, at their own pace, without stress, harassment, or any further tax expenditures. He even agreed that this would likely happen, though only laughed uncomfortably when we suggested that all of the herds that had made their way out of the park for the springtime would have, left to their own devices, also have returned to their chosen summer grounds without his involvement or oversight. Eventually, lunchtime called. Mr. Cunningham and his Montana Department of Livestock truck turned to go, apparently satisfied that wild buffalo in Montana for one more day would not cause a catastrophe of rampant brucellosis. We turned to go as well, saying goodbye to the buffalo friends that we'd been spending the spring with, standing with them through abuse, learning from them during hard times. This morning, the buffalo did migrate east into Yellowstone. This group was accompanied by one mature bull. And as the group crossed U.S. Highway 191, the bull stood in front of traffic while the herd safely crossed the road. The last in the group was an injured adult female. As the bull stopped traffic, the rest of the group waited for her on the other side of the road. After all were safely across, the bull joined them, and they all moved to their chosen summer country together. The basin is lonely now, nearly empty of buffalo, and the camp is lonely too, nearly empty of our dedicated volunteers. Soon, though, the summer crew will take to tabling in the park, educating the masses of visitors to the plight of the buffalo and spreading the word to save the herd. And here it is, volunteers needed in Yellowstone for the summer. Have you ever wanted to camp out in Yellowstone National Park for the summer? Come and join Buffalo Field Campaign this summer as we work to spread the word to save the herds. We are now accepting volunteer applications for our summer outreach program beginning June 15th. That's screaming right up. And going until Labor Day weekend, our goal is to spend July and August tabling and sharing information with Yellowstone visitors inside the park about the issues surrounding the buffalo. We ask for a minimum 2-week commitment from anyone interested in coming on out. To apply, go to their webpage, fill out the volunteer application, and email it to the Buffalo Field Campaign. And you can get all that information at the Buffalo Field Campaign webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They also have lists of things they need, and of course, money is right at the top of that list. Send all you can to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957 West, Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions, call Mike or any of the crew out there, 406-646-0070. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957 West, Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. You can find out that information and more at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And an ivory smuggling destination, Thailand, makes the biggest seizure of tusks ever. This story by Jurawi Kittislipa and Amy Sawita Lefevre, editing by Nick McPhee of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Thai customs officials have seized 4 tons of ivory worth $6 million, authorities said, in what the department called the largest bust of its kind in Thailand's history. Elephant tusks were hidden in bags containing dried beans in containers originating from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Thai Customs Department said in a statement, and were bound for Laos. The seizure comes as Thailand, a top destination for African ivory smuggling in Asia, is under increasing pressure to crack down on its illegal ivory trade. Thailand was given until the end of March to take measures to shut down domestic trade in ivory or face sanctions under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Any sanctions could impact Thailand's trade in species covered by the convention, including ornamental plants such as orchids. We consider this the largest seizure in Thai history. We believe that this ivory was due to be sold to customers in China, Vietnam, and Thailand, the Thai Customs Department said in a statement. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. And you can listen to a rebroadcast right here at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. If you happen to be in Moscow, Idaho, please tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow at 90.3 FM. Monday nights at 9:30 for a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update. Or you might go on the web to northbysouthradio.com. That's northbysouthradio.com, where sometimes they're on the air and sometimes they're playing the Earth First Update. And you can always go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous edition of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio News and is presented in this, produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.